You're listening to The Dan Nichols Show.
This week on The Dan Nichols Show, we go both to Sun City and to France because I am at the ABSA Golf and Paddle Charity Day, and one of the guests has flown in from his palatial residence in France just to be part of it. He'll look familiar, but he won't sound familiar because the accent is properly French now. But for rugby fans, someone we watched very fondly with his time in the Free State, his time in the Bulls, his time in the Springbok jersey, and his time beating up unsuspecting opponents in the French League, which is basically how French rugby works. He's also a good friend of mine and someone who's kept my LinkedIn account clogged up over the last few months, Monsieur Philippe Van Amer, welcome.
Dan, lovely to be here. Thank you very much.
Literally, just landed in from France and rocked up to come and hit a few golf balls and have some fun.
Yes, fresh in from France. Breath still smells of frog legs. but lovely to be in Sun City. I haven't been in a while and it's still as a lovely place as ever.
Life is now in France. We'll dig into that move a little more later. But where do you find yourself now? What is life post-rugby for Monsieur Philippe?
Yes, Dan, we have to keep busy to keep out of mischief. There's no more rugby involved. We're doing some data consulting, so data strategy and writing platforms for firms like ABSA, etc. But in the back end, you know, like I used to do the dark arts of rugby, so we try and help people sort their data out.
And all of that comes from the time you spent in France, and I think the way you've been able to transition out of rugby and into life thereafter while staying in France is a great example for many young sports stars. But let's go back a little further to a young Philippe Rudolf van der Merwe, who in great Afrikaans tradition is, of course, the son of Philippe Rudolf van der Merwe, and your dad a Springbok. Yeah. Was there ever any question? I mean, if you'd gone to your father and said, Pa, I think I'm going to play hockey, how well would that have gone down in the van der Merwe household?
Yes, well, I was lucky that paddle didn't exist back then. No, it was never brought up as a subject. You know, we went to a pretty normal South African Afrikaans school where you were allowed to play every and all the sports. You started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with your tennis, and you did tennis, swim, cricket, rugby, everything, and slept early in the afternoon. So luckily, I was pretty bad at tennis and cricket. So, you know, I kept to rugby, and because I was born with a little bit more meat than the other players, I it quickly made it rugby as good for me.
It's very much in the genes, your dad, but your brother as well, a formidable rugby player. It's one thing to be a pretty decent school player, and if you're playing first team at Grey, it doesn't guarantee you a professional career, but it's pretty close to it. Yeah. When did that decision start to kick in, that mindset of, well, maybe there's more to this than just a bit of fun at school?
Yes, well, I think there's always a lot of doubt, especially when you're younger. You never really think it can be because there's so many professional players. And, you know, when I finished school 2003, it was professional very much, but sort of on the brink. There weren't any pathways and stuff like exist today. School rugby certainly wasn't professional as it is today. And I was quite a late bloomer. I didn't get a professional contract straight out of school. I went studying at COFSIS and quickly learned that actually through your studies you can pay for your and have a little bit of pocket money while you study. So that actually quite helped. And then signed the first professional contract with the Bulls at 24.
It's probably now that you've retired that you have a full appreciation for how important that aspect of your growth was. Because if you'd been straight headfirst into rugby, bang, I've got some money, everybody wants to come and say hello to me at the nightclub, it maybe doesn't give you quite the right perspective that you were actually afforded.
It still happened. You know, I worked for Era as a house salesman, so I made some commissions back in the day. So, and always happy to buy a beer where I can. But yes, gave a lot of perspective of how much work goes into earning a buck actually outside of rugby and in a real job. And I was very lucky to meet serious people back in the day at Sanlam, working for Sanlam in product development. At Era, as I stated, worked a small part for Old Mutual, so actually knew some people in the roadworks, and very, very lucky when the opportunity came to join the Bulls.
It often strikes people as being slightly discordant because on one hand you've got this 2-meter tall monster of a man who's breaking scrum halves in half and spitting them out quite happily, and yet here's somebody who can also happily walk into a boardroom and run through some algorithms and talk through some basic maths, and yet you're not the only one. I remember Selborne Boom was somebody who did something very similar. There are actually quite a lot of the forwards who are a lot brighter than the backs would have you believe, but it allowed you to build up almost these two parallel people.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm in a fortunate situation that I think in my family I'm probably not the cleverest. You know, my brother's an actuary, my sister's is a school teacher. You know, so it was a big fight about, you know, some intellect and math discussions around the table. But there's a lot of pretty clever and intelligent rugby players, especially in the forwards. You know, the backs take too much time putting on makeup and hair. And you know, we've got guys like Yanni Duplessis, you know, who's a doctor, and you know, there's a lot of BCOMs and engineers running around. And I think it's an important part. I think it's an important part that you know, whether rugby or humanly, you challenge yourself mentally as much as physically.
You also challenged yourself to some new horizons because you'd made a name for yourself with the Bulls, very much a favourite at Loftus, a Springbok career. You'd kind of done, if not everything you could have done in South African rugby, then certainly a fair chunk of it, and it would have been easy enough to see out your career here. Instead, you opted to go abroad, and I know there is a financial incentive and that doesn't hurt, but knowing you as I do, I'm sure that wasn't the only reason, and that chance to broaden your horizons beyond just a rugby field was definitely part of the reason.
Exactly. Well, we were on the height of Super Rugby back in the day, and in Super Rugby, when you reach 30 years old, you're sort of old, and they push you to look for new horizons. And there were some changes back in the day at the Bulls as well, which weren't the best, you know, and not with the tradition that we used to at the Bulls. My brother was based in France back then, so I thought, you know, why not go look at and join Clermont-Ferrand, which was a very successful team at the time. Very lucky to join to join those legions of Rougerie and Parra and Le Pondry and those guys, you know. And we won a few caps and we played a lot of finals and lost in a lot of finals, but a great of experience.
I remember speaking to Nick Mallett. It wasn't really a conversation. I asked him one question and came back 3 hours later. But I remember him talking about how at the time he spent in France, things like the French players all bursting into tears in the change room as the emotion swept them up, and a passion for rugby that is not to say we don't have a passion for rugby in South Africa, but there does seem to be a very specific culture and a very specific DNA to French rugby that's different to anywhere else in the world.
The Latin side of the French certainly comes through when there's a little bit of stress that falls on them, where, you know, where the Afrikaans people would probably go into the box and you know, silently go through it. And the French, they very emotional, very vocal, very much, you know, tell us, you know, do as I say, not as I do, type of mentality. It was a very big experience, as I said, coming out of the structures of the Bulls and the Springboks, going into the French side where it's much more laissez-faire. You know, you sort of do it and hopefully someone passes the ball to Rougerie or Penno and he scores a try and everyone's happy.
Nice and simple.
Yeah.
I remember speaking to Dwayne Vermeulen when he came back from France and rejoined the Bulls for the tail end of his career here, and he recalled with a grimace his next door neighbour reporting him for arson because he tried to have a braai in the back garden. There's certainly some different elements of culture.
Yeah.
How easy did you find it to slip into French culture and to embrace elements that could be very different to what you had back home?
It was very tough at first, especially going to Clermont-Ferrand. It's very much like Bloemfontein of South Africa. It's right in the middle. It's extremely French. You know, my first night out there trying to go buy bread and milk, and it was like a 10-minute silent conversation between me and the cashier just to get to pay the stuff. And I thought, okay, this is going to be extremely long, extremely cold winters, extremely hot summers. But it was, we could see where our origins came from, the Huguenots that came over. There's a lot of traditions, how, you know, how we set a table, how we invite people into our houses, etc. That's very much similar to what we do in South Africa, and yeah, just double down and embrace that side. And one by one, you know, you just invite all your neighbors and you do a little bit of a blind. You show them, you know, it's not everyone sits at the table and the food comes out. It's about the conviviality around the fire and around the fire pit. So yeah, we do everything we do in South Africa over there as well. But I do very much miss the land of milk and honey.
I'm sure you do. Yet you've stayed on in France, and so there must have been a point where it became appreciably less alien, where Flip had become Monsieur Flip, and you'd started to take on a bit of the local feel for things. Was that appreciable? Did you suddenly wake up one morning and think, oh, hang on, I've just thought to myself in French rather than English or Afrikaans?
We do speak a lot of French at home, so you know, you're subconsciously does become a little bit more French than it should be. And my kids, you know, speak French at home, which shocks me every morning, you know. You know, I tried growing the little fine moustache and it didn't really sit well. But
I saw a picture of that. It was horrible. And I think it would have had you banned from all primary schools.
Exactly. No, it was one part. I went there professionally and finished my MBA and got a job. Because I could still speak French, got a consulting job from a UK firm to work in France. So it was sort of naturally. And then went for the rugby, stayed for the love. There still is over there, but you know, biggest thing about France, it's a lovely place, but there's French people, so it gets tough every now and then. And certainly, I think I've paid my dues in France now.
Your visa might have just been revoked for that. The decision to stay there has been the platform for what's probably been the big Flip Van Amover story over the last, better part of the last year or so. And it first crept up for me on LinkedIn, where a mutual friend, particularly good friend of yours, Stefan Weyers, who's been involved in sport one or another for a long time, lawyer, has now got this business where he helps people, he coaches, he gives them direction and counsel. And your paths crossed at a very serendipitous time, because in the aftermath of rugby, you generally have two kinds of people. You have Joel Stransky, whose life becomes a non-stop midlife crisis and does three marathons and nine cycling events a week, or you become Dani Rousseau, where there are now three of you where there was one, and you lose so much of what had been at the core of you as a professional athlete, the training, the structure, the discipline. And sadly, to start with, you were very much in that second part, because at one point I remember seeing a photo and saying, that looks like my good friend Flip, but there's rather a lot of him. I'm not sure if it is.
Yes.
And life, by your own admission, you've been very candid and very honest about this, had gone off the rails in that sense.
Yes, Dan, very much. Well, it was a very bigger, shinier piece of me. And I probably started off much more Joel Stransky like after rugby and lost about 5 kilograms and, you know, could run a 5K under 20 minutes and everything was good, and I thought that's what's going to be, and it just didn't really have structure. COVID was very tough on me, and not so much mentally. I just, you know, had too much time on my hands, so a lot of bries, a lot of friends over, good wine, good beers, a lot of French good time, and until, you know, I got two small boys, 3 and 1, that keeps me busy. And I walked up the stairs there, and we've got a family house in Wilderness, and I walked up the stairs with one in my arms, and I basically almost passed out when I got on top. And Stefan came into, well, he was always in my life, and we saw each other at the 23 World Cup, which is Springboks won, if someone forgot. And he, back then already, he told me, you know, the pants are sitting a little tight, don't you want to do something about it? Do you want to just challenge yourself? And I always kept something in my head. I always thought doing, you know, extreme sport or Ironmans is, you know, it's not for the tight five. It's more for the younger, lighter guys. And just, you know, pull the line in the sand and say, okay, well, that's basically what I need to do. I need to challenge myself to something incredibly stupid. And yeah, now, you know, every weekend I basically amaze myself by doing something new. And it's been very good for me. It's been very good for the community around me. And been lucky to have a few media partners, you can call it, that helped me get the story out. And it's been influencing other people. And, you know, as a good friend, old BSP, used to say, it's blessed to be a blessing for others. So the return on my investment has been very good.
you speak a little lightly, I feel, about the personal impact. Yes, almost passed out top of the stairs, but this was a real issue. Your health was coming into play. Young kids, young family, a job that asks some questions of you in a demanding space. It's very easy to seek refuge in that extra glass of whiskey at the end of the night. I just need an extra half hour sleep, I'll run tomorrow. And so you had to understand that you weren't just doing this to look a bit more like a Pierce Beast or a Dan Nicol. You were actually doing this because in 25 years' time, you want to be walking a kid down the aisle. You want to be watching the university graduations. And it wasn't quite make or break, but it was close to it.
Very, very much so. So, you know, it's two things in there. It's got kids quite late in my life. You know, at 40 years old, getting a new baby is challenging. And there's a thing that I need to know. When they are, you know, grown up, I'll be 60, 65. So, you know, I better look after myself. I've got the fundamental genes in myself. So, we walk past a beer and pick up 2 kilograms. So it's important that life stays balanced. You know, you can still have fun, but you need to look after, you know, to continue that legacy. Rugby was a big part of my life, and it's done now, and I needed to get over it. I needed to bury that hatchet and go further and build, you know, my new career as a father and a businessman.
We use the term balance as though it's something you just need to work on. It's out there. It's not too difficult to find. Just make the effort, when, of course, it is anything but. Is there a sense of balance for you, both in the, well, yes, I'm doing triathlons, but I can still have a beer and a braai, and that, okay, yes, I'm working hard, I've got this successful business, but I'm also at home with the kids, I'm at home with the family, I'm able to see both sides of that?
Yes, very much. And I think, you know, we'll have some very good wine tonight, and it will be a shame if I have to pass on that. It is about knowing what you can handle and being able to, you know, man at night, man in the day, as we used to say. So, you know, tomorrow you have to man up and go train. And I do have a triathlon coming up in 2 weeks, so I probably won't go too crazy tonight. But I still like to have a good time. I need to be responsible. I need to be... I travel a lot for work, so, you know, when I'm at home, I'm at home, and I accord my time, or allow my time accordingly to spend time, quality time with the family. When you're on the work and when you're on the job, as you said, we have to do it, and we have to take full momentum, and you know, always looking forward to that. And it's there's no use in burying who you are. I still, you know, like to have a chat and have a laugh and have a beer, and then, but you have to find that balance.
I always loved watching you as a rugby player. That's how our friendship started, and you have a rugby career you can be enormously proud of. But I think the legacy that you leave, and that you have the potential to leave from here on in, is one that is arguably so much more important, because there are not many people who will have the option of playing professional rugby. There are a lot of people who will hit middle age, particularly as men, who are facing all sorts of physical and mental challenges and need somebody who they can look up to where there is a touch point. And there's not a touch point for most people that I've faced the haka, I've run out at a World Cup. But there is the touch point of, I was 20 kilograms too heavy, and I wasn't going to be there for my kids if I didn't do the right thing. So I admire enormously what you've done, and I'm really proud of the effort you've made and the role model you've given us in that regard.
Just then, it's I think for men especially, and I've been in an unfortunate situation where I've lost 4 very close friends to suicide as well. It's very prevalent in the male sphere. It's we suffer in silence. We don't talk. So that sense of community is very important, and that's what Wingman has given me is a sense of community. And
a Wingman, of course, that's Stefan's business.
Stefan's business. And you know, I used to get paid to go into a change room and you know, get paid to run around and shower naked with other mates, you know. And now there's none of that, and it's a bit weird if you demand it. So it's even though we dispersed all over the world, there's a, you know, we are males, so we challenge each other to show up, challenge other to shut up and work. And then also professionally, it becomes a network. You know, we connected to people from Goldman Sachs or big shot lawyers in Pretoria, you know, all over the world. So there's a big network behind the whole thing as well.
And it's a network that I know you've leapt into with great relish, because it's a touch point to South Africa for you, but it also, as you said, allows this remarkable network of South Africans around the world to connect and to become this great force for good.
Exactly. And through that, it's one of the things that we're trying to tell with a very good friend of mine, Justina Sadrianse, is a thing called winning their away game, because my business was connecting South Africans that live abroad, and that's always the easiest path into business. And instead of having these conversations in silos, we said, well, why don't we just record it and have it toward, open to the world? And that's going quite well in collaboration with the NACA network. Which is very lucky. It's so good to see so many South Africans across the world just performing and excelling in all the different positions.
2 points of connection then. If people would like to follow in your footsteps with Stefan, how do they find out more? And if people want to find out more about this incredible network opportunity and this liaison of South Africans, how do they do that?
Yeah, you mentioned it well. LinkedIn can bit of
nauseating. You and Stefan are on there like 6 times a day.
But the easiest part is probably on the social medias to you know, either go to the website of Wingman or the LACA Network, or either through my LinkedIn page, you can find everyone. It's all on there, and you know, if anyone wants to have a chat, you know, more than welcome to. If I can do it from 154 kgs and finish a half Ironman, I think there's plenty of other people that can challenge themselves and also do it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to Dale Santon joining me at one soon. Dale, if you're watching and listening, I want to wrap up, just drop back to the rugby one more time, because that is still how so many South Africans know and love you, from that terrific career playing in the Free State, playing with the Bulls, playing in France. So many different experiences. It's never the easiest question. That won't stop me from asking it. Yeah. Can you pick from all of those the game that you look back on with the most fondness?
Dan, it's quite a particular match, but it will be John Smith's 100th Test match at Soccer City.
Oh, I was there.
Outside of the results, you know, that we lost the game last minute through a missed tackle by John Smith. We're not going to say that. You know, might we forget? It was just the atmosphere. 102,000 people in Soccer City. You know, I got the nod from Peter de Villiers to start that test match as a sort of a young and upcoming lock, and you know, for myself did quite well, and I will always remember that match with great pride and great fondness, and especially the role that the senior players, guys like John and Victor, played in my life back then. You know, it was formative as a match.
You might be able to hear in the background the noise and music picking up. We're about to head into some celebrations with the ABSA team. So that is a good point to send you off to freshen up ahead of an evening with many, many fans and a few glasses of wine. Flip, it's lovely to see you. Lovely to have you back in South Africa. I've been promising for a while to come and visit you in France. It is still on the cards. But until that happens, I'll be watching closely. I'm not sure I'll be doing a half Ironman, but I do have a couple of challenges on the horizons. And as and when I do them, you'll certainly be part of the inspiration, and you will be for many others as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. I'm going to go take out my smoking as well, so that I can look equally elegant as you. It was great to chat. Thank you very much.
There we go. We know him as a great modern South African rugby player, that towering lock forward who left many bruised opponents in his wake. But for me, the real triumph of Flip van der Merwe, Monsieur Flip van der Merwe, now resident of France, is the work he's done from this 154-kilogram behemoth whose health was not looking too promising to now a lean, trim figure of athleticism who's inspiring so many people with this journey through midlife and putting what's important very much to the fore. A great guest to have here at the ABSA Golf and Paddle Charity Day with Leon Spies and team. I'm off to join myself as well. Thanks for joining us this week on the Dan Nicholls Show with our extra special guest, Flip van der Merwe.
You're listening to the Dan Nicholls Show.